from the Sky News Centre at 6. A man who's on the run and claimed he was a Novichok poisoning victim has been jailed in his absence for 11 years. Drug dealer Alex King, who's 42 and from London, faked being ill in Salisbury before Christmas. Lawyers of a man convicted over the death of a woman in a speedboat crash in London say his life will be in danger if he's jailed in the UK. Jack Shepherd has appeared in court in Georgia, where he's handed himself in after months on the run. He'll stay in prison there while British authorities lodge an extradition request. Our crime correspondent Martin Brunt has been in court.
The prosecutor was telling the judge that he should be extradited. He had to face the outstanding jail sentence of 6 years in the UK that he's never served a day of. He also faced a grievous bodily harm allegation against a barman in Devon.
A woman's been charged with arson with intent to endanger life following a huge fire at Nottingham Railway Station a year ago. She was rearrested this morning. A former political adviser to Donald Trump insists he'll plead not guilty to what he's calling politically motivated charges against him. Roger Stone is accused of obstruction, tampering with witnesses and lying to Congress about the release of hacked emails which were damaging to Hillary Clinton. Outside the courthouse in Fort Lauderdale in Florida, he defended his actions as crowds chanted "lock him up."
Any error I made in my testimony would be both immaterial and without intent.
Staffing shortages by American air traffic controllers is triggering delays for some airports. It's being blamed on the partial US government shutdown. It's one of the busiest days of the week for air travel in America. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
Love Bristol.
Love, love, love.
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Bedminster, Celia Phipps, and former Bradley Stoke Mayor and UKIP NEC member Ben Walker. We're also joined by New York-born former international relations lecturer Ron Mandel. And we'll be joined after the 7 o'clock news by the author of the German language All Smoke and Mirrors blog, Alice Schall und Rausch. That's Manfred Petrisch. After the 7 o'clock news, so what if some election loser like Tommy Robinson turned up in Bristol and said that Marvin Rees had cheated in the elections? Tommy declares himself mayor with his followers, becoming Bristol City Council's senior management. Then London and Brussels back Tommy. Well, that's what happened in Venezuela this week. Maduro is facing some kind of coup attempt. But as with Chavez in 2002, the Venezuelan army are standing firm so far. On top of the greatest oil deposits anywhere in the world. That's Venezuela after the 7 o'clock news. And McCarthyism, is it alive and well? Is it thriving in the Labour anti-Semitism row? Are comparisons justified? And it's also Holocaust Memorial Day this weekend. Why is the Nazi Holocaust of the Jews and not other genocides celebrated on that day? Or are they? I never heard of the Magnitsky Act. The US passed it, now the EU is following suit. We speak to author and financier Alex Craner, whose Bill Browder hoax book is all about the act. That's all in the second hour. News review in a minute after Bristol's two weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 10, light rain and showers and some gusty winds. Next week, highs around 7, sunny spells and showers. next weekend. That's the 2nd and 3rd of February. Highs around 5, partly cloudy with showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So it looks like a little sprinkle of snow we had last week in South Gloucestershire, Ben, was it for winter.
Oh, well.
What is going... I mean, OK, it does seem that we've had a very, very mild winter, hardly any snow whatsoever. Can I just ask the three of you what you make of it? First of all, you, Ben.
Well, it must be Brexit, isn't it? Surely, because we blame everything else on Brexit, so I'm going to say that's what it is. Surely, has to be.
OK, Ron?
I think it's just a quirk, and a very lucky quirk as well.
And you like it?
Yes.
Yeah, OK. Senior?
I think it's climate change, isn't it? I think it's something that we've got to all start thinking about right now.
Well, it certainly seems as if there's far less ice and snow around than there was even just 10 years ago. Quite what that's all down to. Well, that's anyone's guess right now. Something we should be looking into. In fact, if you go onto the dialect page, you will find about 4 or 5 months ago, we had quite an in-depth discussion about whether climate change is man-made with two completely opposite people on the spectrum. One was the head of climate science at Bristol University, and the other one was the brother of the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn's brother Piers Corbyn, who's a climate sceptic, and they go at it hammer and tongs for about an hour. It's quite an interesting... I won't say who I think comes out on top at the end of it, but I think you'll probably agree. Anyway, look, let's have a look at some of this week's stories. And Celia, I think we better start on a bit of a gloomy note, get that one out of the way, which is the apparent, anyway, death threats against some of the senior politicians, the Deputy Mayor Asher Craig and the Mayor Marvin. This isn't really this week, it's last week. But how has it gone down in the council, and is it something that is, you know, you find completely out of the blue? Is it something that councillors get trained for in any way, or that sort of thing?
I don't think we get trained for. You are taught about looking after yourself and protecting yourself, you know, lone worker and that sort of thing. I mean, the whole point of being a councillor is getting out and meeting the community, so you have to be aware that there is a level of risk, but it is totally unacceptable for people to threaten lives. I think it's totally unacceptable for people to do the same on Twitter and Facebook and other social medias. I've got a Twitter account. I'm not the biggest Twitter fan, I have to admit. I always try and tweet in the positive. So if I've been to something that's really good or I have a message I want to pass on, I'll use Twitter. But I'm not going to entertain much conversation on Twitter because I'd rather you either spoke to me on a phone or an email.
Well, we're going to hear the Mayor, Labour Mayor Marvin Rees's response now to the death threat outside his house. It was chalked on the street outside in figures saying, "Marvin must die." So let's have a look and see how our Mayor reacted to that on the Sunday Politics, I think this was, on the BBC last weekend.
Well, my first reaction is to imagine someone hunched up outside my house at night within 10 metres of my daughter's bedroom. Then beyond that, it's what am I going to have to do to keep my family safe? And then beyond that, how am I going to get my kids out? And what impact is it going to have on them? How am I going to help them to navigate what's being said about their father?
Ben Walker, as former mayor of Bradley Stoke, what do you make of this?
Well, yeah, I didn't receive any death threats. Not to my knowledge, anyway. But it's not right. I mean, you know, councillors, you know, politicians, you know, yeah, okay, they're in the political sphere, and you know, they're out there for the public. But it is just not right for them to have to go through, you know, that sort of behaviour from people. I mean, I'm a huge advocate of free speech, but I think when you start to just, you know, blatantly insult people and be abusive, that's just not right, and it shouldn't happen.
Ron, this is criminal, isn't it, actually? So there is free speech still, but this is not free speech, this is a crime.
Yeah, that's a hate crime. And I really feel sorry for the family, because I understand when the mayor came out, he was with his two sons, and he had to stand over the letters D-I-E to protect them, because he didn't want them to be traumatized by seeing that. And that is, you know, something that really hits home, because... he's a family man. You know, he's just not an individual. He has a family, and that kind of behavior is despicable and has to be condemned.
Let's go on to another story. There's Alex Salmond, quite shocking this week, accused of many charges to do with abuse of women, including two charges of rape. Now, whether he's done that, of course, is not for us to say. It's for the court to decide. But let's have a listen now to one of the ways that Alex Salmond, since he stopped being the leader of the Scottish National Party, he's been doing this on Russia Today, the Russian English language TV channel.
Welcome to the Alex Salmond Show and to a packed Brexit special. In a week where the full extent of Britain's Brexit burach was laid bare, we interview three senior MPs across the main parties to try and make some sense of it all. First up, we have Vauxhall Labour MP Kate Hoey. 2 weeks ago, we featured Alistair Campbell, who said it was time to bin Brexit. Now Kate replies. She says it's time just to get on with it. Then we have the chair and the vice chair of the Commons Select Committee on International Trade debating that key Brexit issue.
Well, I imagine the broadcasters will not, he will not be continuing that programme. That's definitely going to have to stop. But as to whether he did it, well, he put up a pretty spirited defence outside the court yesterday.
Yesterday, with my solicitor, Callum Anderson, I attended a police station in central Scotland. I was released on condition that I came to the court today to face the charges against me. That I have now done. So let me say at the outset, I am innocent of any criminality whatsoever. As you'll remember, in the long process of judicial review, I made it clear in order to respect the court that I would make no comment until proceedings had concluded. That I did in the statement I made in the steps of the court of session 2 weeks ago. Now that these proceedings, criminal proceedings, are live, it is even more important to respect the court. And therefore, the only thing I can say is I refute absolutely these allegations of criminality. And I'll defend myself to the utmost in court. I've got great faith in the court system of Scotland. I've got recent cause to have great faith in the court system of Scotland. That is where I'll state my case. Now, I'm informed court rules are that your questions and my answers might well breach court rules. You know me well enough to know that I'd love to say a great deal more, but I've got to observe the rules of the court, and in court is where I'll state my case. And therefore, if you'll forgive me, I'm going back in to consult my legal team. Thank you very much indeed.
Former leader of the SNP, Alex Salmond there, turned radio presenter on RT, a show which I imagine this is going to put the kiboshes on that. Now, Celia, not really wanting to say anything about the rights and wrongs of Alex Salmond in this particular case. Let's let the court decide, as he says there. But it's a bit of an extraordinary turn of events, isn't it? Just 2 weeks ago or so, Alex Salmond won a court victory himself against the accusations that some of these people have been making against him. It's almost as if these two former, well, she's still the leader, Nicola Sturgeon. I always find it a bit peculiar. They're both fishes, the sturgeon and the salmon. Anyway, they're daggers drawn.
Mm-hmm. I haven't really been keeping up to speed with this one, I have to say. I saw him on the telly last night, but...
What do you make of the SNP and how important they are these days? I mean, they had their referendum, didn't they? They decided to stay. But so it's almost as if the SNP is kind of a bit in the doldrums, and maybe infighting is taking over when you haven't got such a clear direction.
Yeah, maybe that's, there is such a lot of uncertainty, isn't there? That's the issue. And also I think there's a lot of people with strong values held on either side, so... It's not about being right or wrong. It's about people having their own opinions. But actually, what they're doing is causing a division.
Well, I don't know enough about SNP politics, but it seems to be a clash of egos. We have two very outspoken, one a former leader and one a current leader, with very strong views. And it's interesting, it might be mirroring the divisions within the other two parties over Brexit. Although the SNP basically has a more coherent position, a more consistent position than the other two parties, the Conservative and the Labour. But I think it's more about clashing personalities.
Ben, is it quite extraordinary, isn't it? So 2 weeks ago we heard a court victory for Alex Salmond, and now it's him that's in the dock.
It is really extraordinary. I mean, what bugs me a little bit about this is the fact that it's trial by media and trial by social media, even before anything's happened.
Well, he's very, very careful there not to make it that. But you're quite right.
But it is
his
happening.
His complaint was about all the information about the complaints against him.
That's right.
Released to the press, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know if if he's innocent or not, but I'd like to see the process take its procedure and see where that goes. And when, to come back, I mean, the SNP, I think they're like any other sort of mainstream political party. We've all got problems at the moment, and we're trying to wrestle with different issues. And well, the thing is with the SNP as well, who knows how it could go? They could actually become quite important very soon to the Labour Party. Who knows?
Well, talking about party difficulties, I wonder if you could take us through some of what's been going on in the UK Independence Party recently. I'm never quite sure, because I know that you're very much against the moves towards the far right in the party, whether you're even still a member now or not, Ben.
No, I am still a member, and I still sit on the NEC. I mean, we have a problem with this close association with Tommy Robinson. Some members are quite fond of him. I am not. I am a Libertarian at heart, and I don't buy into many of his messages. Whilst I understand where they're coming from, and I completely sympathise that you know there are bigger issues around them, but I certainly wouldn't make it my business to target one section of society and blame them for everything.
So, I mean, he's been basically blaming Islam for almost everything, hasn't he? So
effectively,
if you have that in the UK Independence Party, then you're a racist party.
I think you find it very difficult
and you're
to
a
argue.
Of that racist
yeah,
party.
I think you will find it very difficult to argue against that point.
Did you have any qualms about staying? Because lots of people in the last few weeks have left UKIP, haven't they?
They have actually. Although membership is up. Which is quite surprising, I guess, in some respects. But, yeah, a lot of people have wrestled with it. A lot of people who have gone as well are kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe fair-weather people as well. But it is a massive issue, and there, you know, if it goes any further...
What is Tommy Robinson's actual connection to UKIP right now?
So he is friendly with our current leader, and he is a special advisor on grooming gangs and Islam to him. That's not a party appointment.
Is he paid by...
No.
Unpaid special advisor to the leader. This is it all sounds a little bit unofficial and dodgy to me.
Well, because the NEC blocked that, we didn't allow him, so that's why
it happened anyway.
Kind of.
So,
yeah.
Would you say you're sort of in there fighting as you decide rather than leave, you try and stay and straighten things out? I mean, that's almost the hidden message you seem to be saying here.
Is it? Anyway, possibly.
Ron, what do you make of this whole debacle with UKIP and Tommy?
I think it's the infiltration of an overt racist and possibly quasi-fascist influence within the party. Whether you might think about UKIP's position on Brexit, it was a party that basically had a fairly... well-reasoned argument for Brexit. Well, many people might disagree with it, but it was a party that was not on the fringes of British politics. I think it's now moving towards the fringes of the far right, and I think it's very worrying.
It's worrying in a way that the membership is up, despite people like Tommy Robinson now being part of the special advisors on Islam to the leader.
Yes, it is. And it's hard to explain other than the fact that possibly a number of people have said as a fallout of Brexit, there's been more xenophobic and more racist discourse, which is now being more accepted within society.
Let's ask the man in the middle. How do you explain the rise in membership, Ben?
From what we've seen, it's not... So the argument to have Tommy on board was the fact that the guy's got a million followers on Facebook, right? Now, what we've seen with his association with UKIP, there has been a rise in membership, but not a million. So the people that want him on board, who think that it's going to make us grow, you know, massively, are wrong, because it's not. You know, he's had a chance and it's not worked out that way. But what we have seen is an increase in membership from disaffected Tories and Labour members.
Celia, what do you make of UKIP? It's a bit of a demise in many ways because of the lack of credibility of having a racist in their midst and advising them on such an important part of society as Islam.
Well, I obviously find it very, very difficult to encounter any political party that will allow racism. It's again not acceptable. I mean, I came here to talk about mental health. We'll talk about that a bit later. But I mean, it's how people feel is extremely important. I think we were talking earlier about, you know, media and sound bites and how people get their information nowadays. And I think many get it in sound bites of kind of information, which is sometimes misinformation because they've not quite picked up the right message or got made use of the information they've got. People make their own views based on small amounts of information. And if you look at something like Article 50, it's a massive 500-page document. I haven't read it. I'm sure there's, you know, many, many, many people who haven't read it. It's very complex. So if you start looking at the complexities of politics today and economics and all of that, really you do need the facts to be really well put out in a way that people can understand.
Ron, this is an old trick, though, isn't it? Getting people to hate another race because of whatever social ills there might be around at the time. Say, for example, austerity.
Yes, very much so. I mean, all you have to do is look back at Nazi Germany. I mean, it's very appropriate today because in Bristol, we commemorated Holocaust Memorial Day at the City Hall. Nazi Germany basically rose during a period of extreme and sustained depression, and the Jews were made a scapegoat for the economic woes and also possibly for the defeat of Germany during the First World War. So very much so, there is a very strong connection between austerity and racism.
So how are you going to clean things up in UKIP, Ben? Do you think you can?
I think... What, me? I think it's entirely possible, but I think this is the last chance saloon in terms of which direction the party takes. So there is going to, after the May locals this year, there is a leadership election, of which we don't know who the candidates will be yet, but I think that's the point when the membership will choose the direction they go. And I think the people, the stragglers, or people that aren't sure what to do, will eventually make up their mind. So we shall see.
Okay, mental health you mentioned there, Celia. Let's have a listen now because it came up at Prime Minister's questions this week.
John Mann. Speaker, on the Monday before Christmas, my constituent Nathan Garrett, aged 18, was referred by his GP for emergency mental health support. On the Tuesday, he was helping others, delivering my Christmas cards as he delivered many leaflets in elections over the years. And later he asked the crisis team for emergency help, and none was forthcoming. On the Wednesday, Nathan went missing. And on the Thursday, I learnt at the volunteers event that we have every Christmas, and I was expecting to see him, that it all got too much for him and he'd taken his life. Nathan Garrett was a brilliant, engaging, kind young man. He was a county athletic champion. He was a talented, brilliant musician. He was incredibly popular. His parents and his grandmother are here today. Would the Prime Minister agree with me that when a teenager needs emergency mental health support, that support should be available within 24 hours? And would she ask her appropriate minister to meet with me and Nathan's family in order that we can push that forward today?
First of all, can I say to the Honourable Gentleman that I'm sure that all members of the House will join me in sending our deepest condolences to Nathan's family and friends and all those who knew him. It sounds from what the Honourable Gentleman said that he was an incredible young man. Every life lost is a tragedy. The incidents that we see of suicide are deeply concerning, and that's why we're taking action in relation to suicide prevention. The Honourable Gentleman has also raised the issue of mental health provision, and we recognise the importance of increasing the provision for people who are suffering from mental health problems, and I'm very happy to ensure that the Honourable Gentleman can meet the appropriate minister to discuss this.
Well, that's an incredibly moving speech, isn't it, to know that, and we know that that is unfortunately not an uncommon circumstance, which is, in Bristol we've launched Thrive programme last year, which is really about making mental health as important as physical health. You could say, my view, that I think it's almost more important. The way you feel, your well-being is a very important thing. And we know that lives are damaged by poor mental health, by trauma, by a whole range of circumstances. Often they're not an individual's fault. It's something that has happened to them. So I was really pleased. I was nominated to be the Local Government Association Champion on Mental Health for Bristol, which means that I have the chance to hook up with Time to Change, an organisation that's working really hard across the country to make a really big deal about mental health. And we were successful in Bristol in getting a Time to Change hub. I'm chair of the Bristol Anti-Stigma Alliance, which is a partnership group, and we run a hub. It's supported by the Bristol Independent Mental Health Team, a group called Wellbeens, and Rethink. So it's working really well with people who've got lived experience, and that's the key and important thing, that people who have actually experienced are really, really drawn into and part of what we do for change.
Isn't there one sort of elephant in the room here, and that is that a lot of young people just feel they're on the scrap heap, that there aren't the jobs for them? If there are, they're very low-paid jobs that many of them can't even afford the dignity of being able to move out from their parents.
Yeah, I think it's about resilience for young people, and that's why there are 11 streams in the Thrive programme, well, one of those is children and young people, and that's about building resilience. That's working at the right point in people's lives to help them be resilient, to help them understand, you know, get people to talk about it. I think that's a really big, we're dreadful in this country about talking about mental health, and you know what we've got, and one of the reasons I wanted to come on this week is to tell you about the Time to Talk Day, February the 7th. Last year we were down the bus station giving out bags of tea and said, if you don't do anything, have a cup of tea with your mate and talk about it. You know, it's really important, and particularly for younger people, men and women. You know, it really makes a difference.
How much of this is this to do with austerity, do you think?
Some will be. Some will be. If life's already tough and complex, and you're struggling, having no money isn't going to help. Having a poor place to live isn't going to help. So that's the Thrive programme actually works across all the departments. So it looks at housing, employment, all of that stuff is important. That's what makes, you know, it's not a health model. It's a health and social care model.
Ben, what do you make of this increase in suicides? I mean, basically, we seem to be funding mental health less and needing it more all the time.
It does seem that way. I mean, I'm really pleased to hear that Bristol's being quite proactive in terms of what they're trying to deliver. That's good. Being at ex-services as well, I've seen mental health in kind of a different way, and I'm pleased to see that the treatment of that is getting much better. But there is a stigma which exists within people's minds, which no matter what you do in terms of outreach work, it's kind of a mindset that people have. I mean, me as a guy, I barely ever go to the doctors, and let alone talk about how I feel. You know, and I think that's why there's such a problem with young men doing it as well. And I think with the pace of life and how we live now, I think that plays a really big part in mental health now as well.
Ron?
Well, I think we can devote a whole show to mental health. It's my understanding that one out of four adults in England face some mental health issues, whether it be anxiety, depression, possibly abusive drugs, and so forth. As a university lecturer, I could testify that students often feel stressed by exams, and staff often overworked, and they're suffering from stress. The line that universities often take is that it's an individual issue. They don't want to look at the environmental sources, and I really appreciate you asking the question about austerity. But I want to bring attention to the local situation in Bristol University, who's had a record number of suicides over the last year. In fact, personally, the May Day weekend in 2018, my partner and three children were walking across Clifton Bridge, and we saw literally that first year English student jump off the bridge. And I can't tell you the impact it had on the family. Fortunately, my back was turned, so I did not see it. I really felt for the family. My partner wrote to the mother, and they've had correspondence since then. But the University of Bristol appears not to have fulfilled their duty to care to students. And I think there's a suit now waged by the parents of a first-year physics student who was sending emails to her fellow students and lecturers that she was having severe anxiety and had suicidal impulses, and nothing was done to help her, it appears.
Well, this is sounds to me a bit like the someone else's job syndrome.
Yes, it is. But it's the human side of the story. We can't forget that. You know, it's devastating for the survivors, and you just, your heart just feels the pain.
I suppose if you go back 50, 60 years or something, the church would have dealt with a lot of these problems. A lot of people would have gone to the church. That's sort of faded into the background now, though, hasn't it?
Not altogether. I mean, there are many church groups that are very, very supportive and working, you know, with groups, because that's exactly, they're out in the community, they meet people, they know people who know the person who's homeless on the street and might need some support.
So if anyone knows someone who they think that they want to sort of get put in touch with mental health facilities in the city, where's a good place, do you think, Sina?
Well, our mental health services in Bristol are, the best place to look is on Mind's website, or find what website and have a look. And particularly for younger people, there are apps as well for people for self-harming. There's a lot of new things out there. Although we're reasonably well served in Bristol, we clearly need more funding to go into mental health so that we can bring it up to the same level as physical health. It absolutely needs it, because a waiting list, you can't have a waiting. If you're feeling rubbish, you can't wait sometimes hours. You need something now. So we do need to make sure that that's addressed. And that's part of funding of, NHS, CCG kind of areas, isn't it?
We'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
That would
for
be great.
Listeners. And just remind us again of when that event's taking place.
Time to Talk Day, February the 7th.
Okay.
Can I make one last little plug?
Yeah.
One last little plug. The Time to Change has a Champions Fund. We secured £10,000. So that's for assisting people in Bristol who want to run an initiative that's designed to support people and reduce the stigma around mental health. So if they apply to the Time to Change Hub, they might get a look in.
That's brilliant, Celia. Thanks. Back to Brexit now. And there was a fascinating discussion on Channel 4 News earlier this week between two MPs. One, she's the Labour MP who's a Remainer, and a Tory MP who's a Leaver. It's Alison McGovern, you'll hear first, who's a Remain Labour, and then Andrea Jenkins, who's a Leaver. Let's see what you make of this.
The second referendum, as Theresa May put it today, would do all sorts of damage to social cohesion in Britain. That must surely worry you.
I'm we have already done serious damage to social cohesion in Britain by what's gone already. I don't see why we can't have future democratic events. We had a general election in 2017. Brexit was a huge part of that debate. Brexit's going to continue to be a part of our political debate for many years to come. The thing that we all have to do is to make sure that our own conduct is good for social cohesion and not bad for social cohesion. We can't rule out democratic events on that basis.
Andrew Jenkins, you're shaking your head.
Completely. I mean, you know, I completely agree with what you said, actually, as an interviewer. It will affect our communities. I mean, on the day of the referendum result, you know, I had people come up to me. Don't forget, my seat was Labour for 85 years previously, so Labour's been ignoring these people for so long.
That's simply not true.
I, in the end, kept quiet when you spoke. So, but the important thing is, you know, on the referendum day, a gentleman my age, 45, came up to me and said, I'm going to vote in this referendum. I've never voted before. I feel I've finally got a voice and a stake in our country's future. We cannot let these people down. I don't believe it's a sad state of affairs, Alison.
There were hundreds of thousands of people who didn't vote in the referendum who would now like to have their say.
Alison, please stop interrupting me. It's a sad state of affairs when politicians think that they know far better than the constituents who put them there in the first place. I believe in democracy, and we've had the referendum result. We can't keep having the answer until people like you find the answer acceptable.
I believe in democracy too, and that's, we've had a general election since the Brexit referendum.
You just
referendum,
want to stop Brexit, Alison.
And we'll have general elections to come, and we'll have democratic events in the future. And what we have to do is make sure that our conduct as politicians leads the way in terms of social cohesion rather than adding to the division.
Well, there's precious little agreement, so can you agree perhaps that the safest thing now would be to suspend Article 50?
No. I think it's going to be necessary, and Cabinet Ministers have said that too.
Well, why kick it into the long grass even longer? It creates more uncertainty. Let's deal with it head on, and let's get some stability for our country.
Now, from UKIP, Ben Walker, I know you've got to go in a minute, so we'll hear your reaction first. Can you explain Brexit?
No.
Particularly, what about the second referendum? Is that going to happen?
What? I'm not sure about a second referendum. What I do know is that any political commentator or pundit that tells you they know what is going on with Brexit and can explain it are a liar, because I don't think anybody does. But what we do see at the moment, I think, is a definite move to delaying the whole process, and I think that is the way that we are going. What the byproducts of that is, I just don't know, but it does seem to me that there's going to be a delay in some way, shape or form. Now, whether that means European elections again, I do not know, but it seems to me that even to go out on WTO, there's still a whole bunch of work that needs to be done. And with the clock ticking, I don't think they have the time. And I would argue that that's probably been done on purpose.
So if they delay Article 50, that means that we will be taking part in the European elections, surely, that are coming up in May.
I think,
and we're going to have new MEPs, and we're going to have a European Commissioner.
I think that's entirely possible, yeah.
Well, that's not Brexit, is it?
It's not.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us. I know you've got to go, Ben. Thanks ever so much. And we'll see you again soon. But, Ron, let's hear from you now. What do you make of all this? And can you explain Brexit to us, please?
Well, can I just limit my remarks to the second referendum initially? I think the second referendum, the only way that a second referendum could occur, unless it's defensible, is if Parliament cannot come to an agreement over how we're leaving the EU, because it would be a mission that Parliament doesn't have the ability to come to grips with the issue, and then you would turn it back to the people. But I think pragmatically, I think a second referendum is very dodgy for the following reasons. It reminds me of when Ireland, I think it was Denmark, was originally asked to vote, I think, on the Lisbon Treaty, and they voted it down. And then they had a second referendum to vote it through. So basically, it's a way of revisiting an issue until the electorate gets it right. That's the message. And if I were someone who voted for Brexit in 2016, particularly up north, and I come from a socially deprived area, right, and that person said, I've never voted before, this is the first time I vote, I would feel disenfranchised. I would feel insulted. And I would basically feel I would turn my back on electoral politics. And I would think that would be very damaging, particularly for the Labour Party in certain areas up north. I think it would be a very bad a setback, I think, for British democracy.
Celia, you last. Labour Party seem to be wanting to delay things. They certainly don't want Theresa May's deal or a no deal. What's your position? And what do you, can you explain Brexit for us?
No.
Nobody can.
Nobody can. And I think that's partly because of the complexities of it, which, as I said earlier, people, it's hard to understand. I don't understand it. You know, I'm not an economist. I don't understand. I mean, I voted very, very much to remain.
But I mean, surely your job is not to understand it as politicians, is to do what the people decided.
Well, I think there's a point in there, but absolutely. But the first referendum, I mean, first of all, it shouldn't have taken place, in my view, in the first place. But it did.
And well, why shouldn't it? Because, I mean, Cameron was elected. Part of his platform was, I'm going to have a referendum. And he won the election, the general election.
Yeah, then that's a fair point. But I think, probably, how can we actually ever know? But he thought he was going to win it. Therefore, it would be a confirming referendum.
Well, that's right. He thought he was going to get concessions from Brussels,
yeah.
Didn't he? He did a bit of a Theresa May, going backwards and forwards, backwards
and
forwards.
Yeah, so he thought he'd kind of done some work beforehand. It'd be all right. We're all going to be fine, and then we can move on. Unfortunately, that's not what happened.
Do you think we'll leave on the 29th of March or not? What's your crystal ball, Mystic Meg?
Mystic Meg. Probably, she says, hedging her bets. Probably, but you know, you can't leave with no deal. That's absolutely clear. You know, there's no, you don't want Theresa May's current deal, and you don't want no deal.
Well,
so,
I mean, what about people that say that no deal isn't really no deal? It's a World Trade Organization deal. It's just that you haven't managed to come to terms with Brussels. You're doing World Trade Organization instead.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a very hard Brexit, isn't it? You know, I mean...
Look, you mentioned Cameron. I'm going to revisit what he was saying, because okay. This is one of the things I like it when broadcasters do this, and it annoys me that they don't do it enough, going back to what these politicians originally say, especially once they've got some nice job in the City of London somewhere and they've disappeared off the stage and no one really gets a chance to ask them any questions. So let's have a listen to David Cameron and some of the promises that he made back in 2015.
Your decision. Nobody else's. Not politicians, not parliaments, not lobby groups, not mine. Just you. You, the British people, will decide. At that moment, you'll hold this country's destiny in your hands. This is a huge decision for our country. Perhaps the biggest we'll make in our lifetimes. And it will be the final decision. So to those who suggest that a decision in the referendum to leave would merely produce another stronger renegotiation and then a second referendum in which Britain could stay, I say, think again. The renegotiation is happening right now. And the referendum that follows will be a once-in-a-generation choice, an in-or-out referendum. When the British people speak, their voice will be respected, not ignored. If we vote to leave, then we will leave.
Well, will we? Celia, once in a generation choice, he says there. Not twice in a generation, or three times, as Rob was pointing out. You know, how many times do you have one of these referenda?
I do agree with Ron's point about, you know, democracy is important. So if a decision has been made by the public, then it should, to some extent, well, in every extent, probably be respected. I'm not sure about a second referendum. Is a second referendum the same as a people's vote? Because I think, I think they're two different things. A referendum is a formal process, but a people's vote, you could, I would support something like that, that actually gave people another opportunity to voice. Because people, if you listen to current media, they are saying, well, I did vote that way, but now I would change because now I've got additional facts.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to explain it all for us, Ron, in a minute, and tell us exactly what's going to happen on 29th of March, because I'm sure you know, after we've heard from Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May at Prime Minister's Questions, discussing this very topic this week on Wednesday.
Jeremy Corbyn, Mr. Speaker, actually, I did reach out to the Prime Minister last September when I offered to discuss our deals with her. And it appears that, Mr. Speaker, that while the door to her office may well be opened, apparently the minds inside it are completely closed. She has shown no flexibility whatsoever in taking no deal off the table. The Chancellor reassured business that amendments would be put down that would have the effect of removing the threat of no deal, which is binding and effective. Given that those amendments are now tabled, will the Prime Minister confirm that if passed, they would rule out no deal?
The Right Honourable Gentleman. What we have seen is amendments seeking to engineer a situation where Article 50 is extended. Now, that does not solve the issue. There will always be a point of decision, and the decision remains the same. No deal, a deal, or no Brexit. I'm delivering on Brexit. I want to do it with a deal. Why won't he come and meet me and talk about it?
Well, maybe before we hear from Rob, we should ask Senior, why do you think Jeremy Corbyn's not talking to Theresa May about this? Because surely he wants a deal.
Well, I think it's because others are. I mean, there's not much point in having a conversation if the very point of conversation that you want to have is take no deal off the table isn't actually going to be talked about. It's going to be a very short conversation.
Fair enough. Ron, anyway, what's going to happen? You know, I'm sure. 29th of March.
Well, I think everyone's overlooking the EU's response. Everyone's thinking about Britain's response in terms of, you know, whether or not they're going to have no deal and they're going to ratify Plan B or Plan C's version of Plan A of May. I think the EU has a lot to lose from a no deal. They're going to lose possibly a 50, 60, 70 billion pounds, which Britain has to pay as a part of a divorce settlement.
Well, it's going to be at least 39 billion, that's for sure.
All right. And also all the trade agreements and the regulation and movement of people and the rights of EU citizens in this country and expats living in Europe. So I don't think it's an interest of the EU to see Britain crash out without having a formal settlement. So I think the EU might just say, well, we're not accepting no deal. We will wait until you get your act together, basically, to pass some formal agreement that allows a controlled exit from EU.
So what you're saying is probably 29th of March will be no Brexit.
Yeah? No, exactly.
Okay.
That's my prediction anyway.
Well, we're also joined in the studio by Max Lange, who's been sitting very patiently. Max, you are a campaigner with the Lib Dems and others and a film student up at the university on the buses. Do you want to just tell us how you got started on campaigning to get better buses in the city? I think a lot of people will be slapping you on the back listening now in the traffic jams or on the buses crawling along.
Yeah, that's the response I generally get when I approach people at bus stops. They're quite happy to hear that somebody's doing something about it. So I kind of got into it in October. We had amazing woman called Frankie who set up the bus protest that happened in November, and I saw that the kind of response that she was getting and thought, oh, it's not just me that's angry about our bus services. Let's crack on. Let's try and start a campaign and try and change things.
So what with franchising, we've kind of identified this as one of the major problems in that our elected representative like Celia here got no say whatsoever, none of them, in the actual route. So that must be a little bit frustrating, Celia. Do you councillors discuss this as a bit of an issue, that you would like to have a bit more control of the bus franchising so you can set where the routes are, that sort of thing, as councillors?
Well, there is a transport group that is working on this kind of strategy right now. So, and actually working with First Bus to do that. Bristol's a funny shaped city. I think it's a kind of real hub and spoke city. So it is. I mean, you know, we've got a river going across. I know London's got one too, but it does mean the shape of the city has been guided in the past by some of the planning decisions that were made many years ago. I mean, probably post-war, but let's talk about it. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Get more public transport, more integrated public transport. That's what the city needs to reduce congestion.
Max, what is franchising?
So franchising is the system that London uses in its bus service, whereby the authority chooses the routes, the timetables, what types of buses they want, and what the fares will be. And then they go to private companies like First Bus, like Stagecoach, like all of them, and ask them who would like to run these services, and they bid to run those services.
So why do you think that would be better than the current system then?
Oh, for quite a few reasons. It brings back accountability to our bus system. So
the current system basically is first bus run buses wherever they fancy.
Yeah, they can apply to run a service wherever they'd like in the city, and you know, the council can start talking to them and ask them to do things, but at the end they don't have any responsibility to carry out the wishes of the council. And so having a franchise system gives us that kind of accountability, that councillors and our elected representatives can actually make the decisions.
Well, when we were discussing this back in November, I promised on this programme to invite the Metro Mayor on, Tim Bowles, whose powers it is to do that, and I spoke to first, and then also emailed his office. Veronica Brooks contacted me from the mayor's office, which is at 3 Rivergate, Temple Quay, Bristol, BS1 6ER. She emailed me backwards and forwards after about 5 weeks and 10 emails. Also, two reminder emails. I'd basically been saying, look, this is when the programme is. When can the mayor make it? And got no response. At the first couple of occasions, I just gave them a couple of dates, and they said, can't do that. Anyway, eventually, after, like I say, 5 weeks, 10 emails and two reminders later, I got a reply from someone different, from Veronica, called Simon Jupp. And Simon says, I apologise for the delayed response to your request. As you can imagine, we receive a lot of correspondence. I listened to your programme at the tail end of last year. That's after, well, about a month of asking to get Tim. And he was disappointed to hear that you suggested the mayor was evasive and refused to come on the programme when we were yet to finalise a date. Well, this is literally after 10 emails backwards and forwards. I think evasive is fairly fair, actually, to say. Usually it's only one email I explain to him, you know, then they come back and they'll tell me. Anyway, so Simon Jupp is in the mayor's office, and he's finally, then he phoned me up, he didn't email me, he phoned me up to say, look, we're just not going to do this programme at all. What do you make of that, Max?
I think it's disappointing. I think a lot of people in our city and across the whole region don't actually know who the Metro Mayor is and what his responsibilities are. And this position has tremendous power that could actually reshape our region. And if he's not going to be coming onto programmes and actually talking to people about what his role is and what changes he wants to make, then he's not really doing his role very effectively.
I saw him actually at the launch of the, I think it was the M1 route, beginning of January, the Metro Bus, the Metro Mayor, the Metro Bus Mayor, I suppose we should call him, really. And so he sort of pops up and then he disappears.
Yeah,
Have you managed to collar him at all?
No, I've never done that, but I will be going along to some of the West of England meetings to actually go and take statements to him and start asking him these questions.
Well, I hope Simon Jupp is listening. I mean, it's great to know that we've got listeners in the mayor's office to this programme. We shall be seeing if we can locate Tim Bowles at some sort of public event and doorstep him and ask him what is going on with franchising, because it's like this seems to be the common sense way forward in a city to organising some of our buses, at least giving, you know, when you vote, you'd like to think that the people that have got some sort of control over the transport in the city. Do you ever feel a bit helpless when you're sitting in a jam, Senior?
Well, I'm not often sitting in a jam because I walk quite a bit. So, you know, not everyone can, of course, so that doesn't help. But, yes, I mean, if you look at one of those maps that gets created, transport is the issue that comes up time and time again, is that it's not great.
I noticed also, by the way, Max, that the cycling campaign are also criticising him. If you go on to the Bristol Cycling Campaign, they're saying this Metro Mayor Tim Bowles is not listening to us. What do you make of all of this, Ron? Any thoughts on transport in the city? As a fairly new arrival you are, aren't you?
Yes, I think there's just too many vehicles on the road. You could blame First Bus for not running an efficient or reliable bus service, but the point of the matter is there are too many people. It's a vicious cycle, possibly, because people don't have faith in a public transport system, so therefore they use their cars. But at some stage, I think you have to make it less convenient and more expensive for people to run a car or to bring a car into the city center. Possibly congestion charge, possibly higher parking fees and so forth, and then maybe to encourage a bicycle scheme.
Okay, this is very much a stick approach you're talking about here, but what about a carrot? What about, say, free buses from the park and rides? We've got loads of park and rides, half of which are like two-thirds of the park and ride is empty most of the day, so why not? I suppose it's because they don't want to do anything for free. Is that why?
I think so. Yeah, and that's an incentive for people to use.
I don't think many cities do things for free. I mean, Berlin is the most fantastic city to get around. It's very level, but it's got such a really good integrated.
Luxembourg, I believe. I ought to look this up really before I say it. But Luxembourg, I believe, has just made all public transport free.
Okay.
I think it's Seattle is another city in Sheffield just 20 years ago. I think it was something like a 2 pence bus fare. So people use public transport when it's cheap. Mm. In fact, if you go back to Fares Fair, when I was a young school kid in London, the Ken Livingstone, when he was the mayor of London at the time, was cutting down every year. We get less and less fares on the buses. He wanted to make public transport in London free and for the ratepayers to subsidise it. And the result of that was 3,000, I remember the figures very well, 3,000 less serious accidents on the road in the first year of Fares Fair. So this is, you know, it's surely just cutting down the price rather than upping the price. Max, I'll leave the last word to you on the buses. So, Kurt, what are you planning next in your guerrilla campaign against First Bus?
Well, I wouldn't quite call it guerrilla, but we're carrying on with the campaign. We're currently around 2,400 signatures at the moment. We're hoping to get the 3,500 needed to get a debate in the City Council.
Okay, so I'll be putting the petition link up on our website at thisweek.org.uk.
Brilliant, thank you very much. And the aim for that is to get a debate in the council. We've got a motion that will be submitted by one of the city councillors, so there will be a debate on that motion as well, and hopefully a vote in support of franchising in the City of Bristol.
And if you just hang around a minute after the news starts, we'll have a little chat about what we're going to do to doorstep Tim Bowles. Fascinating. Also, final story, I think it's going to be the final story this week. Bit of a shocking one, but I discovered this yesterday. I hadn't seen it reported in any news anywhere. The former Conservative MP Harvey Proctor has been made a contender, he's called a core participant, in the VIP defile inquiry, that is to say the National Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse. I was just looking on Twitter earlier, and quite a lot of the people who were survivors of abuse have said this is a terrible decision, because he is someone who was being accused of abuse, and they're saying, well, as survivors, we will want nothing to do with this inquiry now. So I know it's an awkward question to land on you. Maybe I'll start with you, Ron. This is an inquiry into child sexual abuse. A lot of survivors for many years have been extremely worried about engaging, about talking to anybody about this, and now the inquiry has decided that Harvey Proctor, who many have accused of abuse of various sorts, in fact he's been fined by the courts for it in previous years, is now a core participant of the inquiry. What do you make of that?
The cynic in me basically is a deliberate ploy to sabotage the whole process and basically bring it to a halt. The possible explanation is just incompetence and insensitivity to the victims of abuse.
Well, the person in charge, remember, we're on the fourth chair of this inquiry.
Yes.
And the last one that left was this New Zealand woman, and she left because she said that I'm not allowed to employ my own staff. The staff are being given to me by the Home Office, and I need to investigate the Home Office.
Yes.
And yet it's the Home Office that's appointing my staff. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page as well. It's on the IICSA website. So that's all for this hour. We'll be back after the news. Thanks very much for with our guests. That's Ron Mandel. He'll be back after the news, but Celia Phipps and Max Bristol Langer, and also BCFM Ben Walker from the UK Independence Party. See you after the news.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.